Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Dan Caldwell. He's Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Seaver College, Pepperdine University. He's co-author of the book Seeking Security in an Insecure World, and he will be speaking this Saturday, October 20th at 3 o'clock at the Great Hall of St. John's College here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Your book is called Seeking Security in an Insecure World. Let's start with the basic. What is security? Is the relationship between the security of one nation and that of the nations with which it has relations the definition of security, or what is security?
My co-author, Robert Williams, and I attempt in the book to show that security is really much broader than simply a military security and the security among states. And in fact, one way of putting it is that national security, just focusing on states and the military aspect of security, is really an oxymoron in today's world, that it's much broader than that and incorporates many more issues than simply military security.
What are some of the issues that are incorporated?
One of the issues that has been in the news this last week because of the Nobel Peace Prize awarded to Al Gore is the whole issue of environmental security and climate change. But in addition to that, things such as infectious disease, economic security. So some of these issues that are increasingly important in international relations.
You write about nonproliferation agreements. What, in your view, have been the successes and failures of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty?
Well, the fact that 183 countries in today's international system are parties to the Nonproliferation Treaty, I think, is the first success. Indeed, there are only four countries that sort of lie outside of the Nonproliferation Treaty. And I think that that is a powerful statement that the international community is opposed to the spread of nuclear weapons. And I think that in and of itself is very important. And beyond that, I think just the kind of international norm that sets is an extremely important precedent.
But then there are some negatives, too. For example, Israel, India, and Pakistan never signed on.
That's what I say. There are four parties that are not a part of the treaty. Add to the three that you mentioned, North Korea, that withdrew from the NPT. But I don't think that the best should be the enemy of the good, that the Nonproliferation Treaty has not prevented the spread of nuclear weapons. But on the other hand, it's a lot better than what President Kennedy was estimating in 1963, that by 1970 we could have some 10 nuclear powers, and by 1975, 15 or 20 nuclear powers. So we've done better than that.
What is the significance of those particular nations that have not signed on, not signing on?
Well, I think the India and Pakistani cases are a problem for South Asia, in the sense that India and Pakistan have fought four previous wars, and the fact that they now have nuclear weapons is, I think, somewhat daunting. Israel and North Korea are also problematic because those countries are in bad neighborhoods, and I think in addition to that, they have competitors in their respective areas of the world that I think that the development of nuclear weapons by those countries leads them possibly to think about developing their own nuclear weapons.
What do you mean by bad neighborhoods?
Areas that are prone to conflict because of historic, cultural, or ethnic conflicts that in some cases date back centuries.
You start out the book in your early chapters on the nature of security, the meaning of security, talking about whose security. Are you writing for American, Western, developed country audiences? Are you writing for the whole world? I want to think about security in a holistic way. Are we talking about the security of everybody, or are you talking really more specifically American national security?
Well, my co-author and I are both Americans, and so it's hard to escape one's own sort of ethnic and nationalistic background. So I'm sure that we reflect an American bias. At the same time, we try to look at what security means, not just to Americans, but to people in other countries as well, and not just to what security means for countries, but what security means also for individuals in regions of the world and even the international system as a whole.
Can you say more about that?
What security means to a woman in Bangladesh has a very different meaning than what security means to an American. And I think that, again, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee 2 years ago recognized that in awarding the Nobel Peace Prize to Muhammad Yunus for his development of micro-lending as an approach to development. And I think what he specifically was trying to focus on is trying to increase the economic security of the poor and dispossessed in the world. And I think the Nobel Committee concluded that that was an important step in the direction of creating a more peaceful world.
To what extent do capitalist nations really sign on to that concept? I mean, the history of the last century is certainly one of, or more than the last century. I mean, you know, the whole history of capitalism is economic exploitation of one group toward another group, and that inherently creates conflict. And yet we want to have our stuff. We want to have our nice middle class lives and so on. I mean, it seems like there's a inherently a great deal of insecurity in the very system in which we live.
Well, at the same time, I think people are, you're focusing on the negatives of capitalism and the critique of capitalism. At the same time, I think there's a positive side that, in fact, people have been attracted to capitalistic mechanisms. I think the task is try to restrain the excesses of capitalism and to provide for greater numbers of people to partake in the benefits of capitalism. And I think that's the real value and the brilliance of Muhammad Yunus's work on micro-lending, is that he, in fact, has extended the benefits of capitalism to those who were previously cut out of gaining through individual initiative and their own work and efforts.
We're talking to Dan Caldwell, co-author of the book Seeking Security in an Insecure World. We were speaking a moment ago about the Non-Proliferation Treaty. You also write about counterproliferation. What does that term mean?
Well, a good way of thinking about it, I think, is to say that non-proliferation is essentially what the State Department does in terms of diplomacy, international conferences, that sort of thing. Counterproliferation is really what the Department of Defense does. And there are several different elements of that counterproliferation approach. For example, one aspect of it is the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program that was started 15 years ago to try to make the world safer by sort of securing former Soviet nuclear weapons and also employing former Soviet Russian scientists. So to date, 20,000 Russian scientists have been employed by funds provided through Nunn-Lugar. And in addition to that, some 7,000 nuclear weapons have been disassembled as a result of Nunn-Lugar. So that's one aspect of counterproliferation. Another important aspect is the Proliferation Security Initiative that was announced by President Bush in March of 2003 that provides for countries to intercept nuclear materials that are in transit from one country to another. And that has been signed on by about 15 countries and has been used on several occasions to stop the export of nuclear materials from one country to another.
What kind of export is going on? I mean, is this nuclear weapons type of nuclear material, nuclear power? Is this completely under the table? What kind of export are you talking about?
Well, there are really a couple aspects. One, and the most dangerous, would be the actual export of a nuclear weapon. And to date, thankfully, there have been no instances of one country exporting an intact nuclear weapon to another country. What has been problematic is the export of nuclear technologies, and particularly technologies used to enrich uranium to weapons-grade levels. And there have been several instances of that. For instance, we know that the network established under the Pakistani nuclear scientist, Dr. A.Q. Khan, sent nuclear technologies to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. In fact, Libya paid more than $100 million to the A.Q. Khan network for these technologies. So the task really, I think, is to try to restrict the export of technologies that could lead to the development of fissile materials that then could be used to make nuclear weapons.
Are you specifically talking, when you talk about nuclear technologies, centrifuges?
Yeah, that's what the Khan network, among other things, sent to Iran, gas centrifuges for enriching uranium.
I always wonder about that because the nature of the technology is known to anybody. Is it that hard to make a centrifuge? I mean, is it really something that you have to get in a specific place?
Yeah, there's divided evidence on this in the popular literature, but I think most scientists would say that it's very difficult to actually fabricate highly enriched uranium to weapons-grade level. And then secondly, it's very difficult, fortunately, I think for the world, it's very difficult to make a nuclear weapon. So it's not a trivial task to create a nuclear weapon. Otherwise, Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden would already have one.
Graham Allison, whom you cite in your book and whom we talked to on this program a while back, calls nuclear terrorism the ultimate preventable catastrophe. How successful do you think the U.S. and its allies have been in locking up fissile material and doing what's needed to prevent nuclear terrorism?
Sort of a good news, bad news. On the one hand, the last 15 years under the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program have seen some major successes. On the other hand, there's a great deal to be done. There's still over 100 tons of plutonium and 500 tons of highly enriched uranium in Russia. And so there's a lot more to be done. At the same time, a great deal has been done. I mean, what most Americans don't realize is that as part of the so-called megatons to megawatts program, the United States has bought enriched uranium from Russia and has used that enriched uranium to power about 10% of the nuclear power plants in the United States for producing 10% of the electrical power in the U.S., comes from that Russian uranium.
When you talk about the hundreds of tons of uranium and plutonium in Russia that's still sitting there, is it not properly locked up?
Again, that's something that the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program has focused on, is to provide for greater security at places where there is enriched uranium, plutonium, and or nuclear weapons. And so real progress has been made in that area, but I think there is still much progress to be made there.
In your book, you talk about nuclear terrorism being perhaps less of a threat to non-state terrorist groups than biological weapons, which are probably easier for people to get their hands on. To what extent, well, first of all, what are biological weapons? And to what extent is there really a danger of their being used?
Well, biological weapons are weapons that are results of living organisms that are toxic. And so things like the plague, smallpox, things like that would be biological weapons. And in 1972, President Nixon proposed the Biological Weapons Convention, and that outlawed biological weapons. And to date, more than 170 countries have signed on to the Biological Weapons Convention, 171 have signed on, that outlaw those sorts of weapons. All of that's the good news. The bad news is that the biological weapons can be more easily developed, according to most scientists, than nuclear weapons, because what it would take is a laboratory, similar to a laboratory at any college or university, a relatively small area to develop these weapons. And so that's, I think, an ongoing concern of national security organizations, the United States, as well as other countries.
Well, as you mentioned in your book, the Bush administration withdrew from the Biological Weapons Convention in 2004. Where does that leave the United States and the rest of the world?
No, it really didn't. It didn't withdraw from the Biological Weapons Convention. What the Bush administration refused to do is to participate in an international conference to provide for verification measures for the Biological Weapons Convention. And I think that was unfortunate on the part of the administration. But the United States is still a party to the Biological Weapons Convention.
So how does one guard against biological weapons terrorism? I mean, you have these conventions on the part of nations, but nations aren't the ones who would probably get their hands on them in the first place.
Well, any of your audience who is listening who are older all have smallpox shots, and that's one form of defense against a possible biological weapon, which is weaponized smallpox. Now, unfortunately, it runs out after a number of years, so even those of us who are old enough to have had smallpox vaccines, unless they have been sort of boosted in recent years, they aren't effective. But that's one form of protection. And first responders in the United States, that is firemen, policemen, emergency medical personnel, have had the option of getting smallpox vaccines. Military personnel have had the option of, and I think the requirement in most cases, of getting anthrax vaccinations. So that's one form of protection, and the United States has moved to increase the stocks of vaccines to protect against certain biological weapons such as smallpox and anthrax in recent years.
We're talking to Dan Caldwell. His book is Seeking Security in an Insecure World, and he will be at St. John's College in the Great Hall this Saturday, October 20th at 3 p.m. To what extent are you and people in your field looking at the questions of why individuals and groups would want to use weapons of mass destruction in the first place?
I think that's a key and a very important question, is to focus on motivations. And I think one of the principal motivations is the desire to achieve security. And if that security can be achieved with means other than obtaining nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction, then I think the United States and the international community should move move toward providing that security so that states will not be attracted to developing these weapons of enormous destructiveness.
Well, what do you think that looks like specifically?
I think we've seen a couple of instances of this. For example, Libya, headed by Muammar Gaddafi, thought to develop nuclear weapons for 30 years. And eventually, I think Gaddafi realized that his future and that of his country could better be secured by renouncing nuclear weapons than continuing to try to develop them. So Libya and Gaddafi, after a more than three-decade attempt to buy or develop nuclear weapons, gave them up. And in fact, Libya is better off now that Gaddafi has done that, because the United States, as well as other countries, have opened diplomatic relations, have increased economic trade and things like that. So Libya is actually in better shape, both from a security standpoint as well as from an economic standpoint, having renounced nuclear weapons than developed nuclear weapons.
It seems like the whole world would be better off from an economic standpoint if we could reduce our production of weapons, because it's such a hugely destructive phenomenon, and such a, if they're used, and so even if they're not used, it's such a tremendous economic drain on any economy.
Well, that's true. They are very, very expensive to develop and to maintain. And I think it's very significant that four very high-level and very highly respected policymakers have proposed that nuclear weapons actually be eliminated. George Shultz, William Perry, Henry Kissinger, and Sam Nunn in January of this year wrote an opinion editorial in the Wall Street Journal in which they proposed a system for moving toward the elimination of nuclear weapons. And so, you know, this was liberals, conservatives, Republicans, and Democrats proposing to move toward the elimination of these very destructive weapons.
You're a professor at Pepperdine University. What has been your experience in actual government in all of these areas that we're talking about?
I was a naval officer, and while I was in the Navy, I served, among other places, in the Office of Emergency Preparedness in Washington, D.C., which was responsible for what was called continuity of government, which means what happens after an attack or a natural disaster in the United States. So I have some limited government experience, but most of my experience has been in academia.
It's interesting. We were talking to Richard Rhodes, who was also part of this series of the Santa Fe Council on International Relations, and I asked him something that I'd like to also ask you, namely, especially during the Cold War, metaphors of balance of power, you know, the scales tipping this way and that way, were often used when talking about security, and that is an inherently kind of precarious metaphor. And I was wondering if there was a different set of metaphors or ways of thinking about security that you think is more solid, more grounded.
Well, I think during the Cold War, the sort of balance of power was a bipolar balance of power with the United States and the Soviet Union. And in fact, it was relatively more simple than the situation today that incorporates not just two great powers, the United States and the Soviet Union, but incorporates nine different countries that possess nuclear weapons, as well as several countries that are attempting to develop nuclear weapons, as well as some subnational groups such as Al-Qaeda that are also attempting to obtain or develop nuclear weapons. So the situation today is much more complex than during the Cold War, and I think there really is both a positive and a negative in that. The positive is that today there is a less of a probability of a global conflagration resulting in the deaths of millions of people. The downside of today is that there's a higher probability that a weapon of mass destruction would be used. So we have a mixed picture, and I think on the whole, when we look at it, despite the threats that we face today, the world is a safer place today than it was during the Cold War.
Well, we will leave it there for the moment, and we look forward to seeing you on Saturday, the 20th of October, in the Great Hall of St. John's College here in Santa Fe. You'll be speaking. What is the title of your talk?
Clouds on the Horizon, Eroding Constraints, and the Seductive Attraction of Nuclear Weapons.
Well, we will see you then in this talk sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Dan Caldwell, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
You're welcome.
Dan Caldwell is Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Seaver College at Pepperdine University, and he's co-author of the book Seeking Security in an Insecure World. You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'd like to introduce Erica Wanamaker. She is an artist, and her exhibition, I Stole Stealth, Coyote Taught Me, opens at the Linda Durham Gallery tonight from 5 to 7 p.m. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
What is the meaning of the first part of the title, I Stole Stealth?
Let's see. I decided a couple of years ago, I was thinking about how the right pretty much co-opted tactics and strategy of the left. They studied it, and they co-opted it. And I decided I was going to do the same thing by stealing objects of power, metaphorically, or however else I feel like doing it, from the right. So one of the things that I decided I would steal was stealth. And it kind of came from my working with the coyote archetype. Coyote steals things. Coyote steals from the people and the gods and people in power for himself and to bring back to the community. And that's kind of what I feel like my job is to retrieve information for my community. So stealing stealth was like stealing a power object and using it.
And specifically in the show at the Linda Durham Gallery, you are using the shape of the stealth fighter,
yeah,
as the form for a lot of your artworks.
Yeah, because the stealth fighters have been stationed at Alamogordo in southern New Mexico, and they would fly over Santa Fe and mostly the Pecos a lot. And if you've ever seen them fly, they are one of the most evil looking things you've ever seen. I mean, they look like flying evil. So, I don't know. They're just really intense power objects. And that was the thing. Coyote, one of his jobs is to steal, and stealing stealth. It's also about stealing the ability to be invisible or be unnoticed. And for me, that was really important to do on purpose, to make sure I was invisible when I wanted to be invisible and to be visible when I needed to be. So stealing stealth is, for me, a strategy personally. It's to make sure I know when I'm there and showing up and when I want to be unnoticed.
In terms of the objects themselves, when you make them, you subvert the meaning of them. So instead of the stealth fighter being something that is, you know, as you call it, flying evil, there's a lot of other functions. I mean, some of them are very pretty.
Well, yeah, I'm kind of self-identified as a witch. I call myself a culture witch. And so one of the aspects of magic is being able to change one's consciousness at will. And that's not just your own, but other people's. So taking these images of power and just turning them a tiny bit, just taking a little twist, is what changes it. So like a big pink stealth. This is the big pink stealth in the show. It's pink car paint, sparkle car paint with orange flowers. And it's a girl stealth. It's like, yeah, it's called My Trick Ride.
It's funny because we were talking about this before when I saw some of the work in your studio that in Czechoslovakia in the old days, in the Russian days, the Soviet days, there were these artists who would always used to paint this tank pink, and then they would paint it green or black again, and then they'd paint it pink.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is about, you know, it's that old subvert the dominant paradigm. It's about taking it and changing it to your own and making it your own. And so, you know, I stole stealth, and it was kind of interesting when I decided that's it. I stole stealth. Now I own stealth. That was about the time that they decided they were decommissioning that F-117 aircraft. It's like, wow, I'm good.
Now tell me truthfully, do you have the feeling that through making them you actually somehow participated in disempowering the war machine?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's what I do. All the sculptures I make are spells, and magic is real. I'm here to say magic is real. It's the art of changing consciousness at will. If you just make someone to see things the way you see them, or just show them something, that's magic. I mean, it works. It absolutely works. I have definitive proof.
How did you learn magic? I mean, is this something that is just inherent in art making, or what traditions are you working with?
I think it's inherent in my art making, and it took me a while to realize that that's what I was doing. But the model that I've always had as an artist, even as a young artist, was really the shamanic model. And I kind of hate to say it in Santa Fe because it's so full of like, ooh, new age shamans and stuff. But it really is. The shaman is the, not just the trickster, but they're the agent of change for the community. And I think this is primarily the role of artists, is to bring information from one side, from unconscious and to consciousness, to the community. So I've always felt that was my job. I mean, it's one thing I'm good at. I'm good at going and bringing these, they may be just emerging archetypes, into the open, into consciousness, bringing the stories to other people so I can share them and, you know, pass information around. And you know, that's what I've always felt my job is as an artist. And, you know, you always think about how can I change the world? And, you know, I want to do something for the good. This is what I've decided my job is. This is how I can do it. And frankly, I'm good at it.
We're talking to Erica Wanamaker, and her exhibition is called I Stole Stealth, Coyote Taught Me. It opens tonight at the Linda Durham Gallery from 5 to 7 in the evening. So you're working with archetypes like Coyote and others. How do you access them? Tell us more about this process.
Well, this show has not, besides the stealth pieces, there's some pieces I made earlier in the year that I showed in New York in January. And there's snake, coyote, hummingbird, cicada, a couple others. But, they're all what I feel like are allies of mine. They're plants and animals and that I've worked with before that have taught me certain things. And it's something that has always come really naturally to me. But when I sort of look back at my work, thinking about this show that I was making for New York last year, I thought about all these different archetypes I've worked with and what specific gifts they've given me. And there's a book I use a lot when I teach. I teach sculpture at the community college here. And a book I use and always refer people to is Lewis Hyde's book, The Gift. And it talks about building community through art and how the work doesn't come from you, it comes through you. So how do you get to that spot that that you are given the gift? You know, you are in an empty place, and it is the most uncomfortable part of the work, waiting for the stuff to show up. But the way you get to it is prepare yourself in your own way, keeping the paths clean, you know, whatever it takes, practicing, going in your studio every day, cleaning your studio, doing what you need to do to be prepared so you're in the spot. You know, it's people talk about the muse. Well, the muse doesn't just show up. You have to work to make it show up. So it's about, like, preparing to be in that spot. But once you're there, that truly is the gift. Because one moment, you're like, oh, man, I wish I could think of something to make. I mean, I'm waiting. And then the next minute, it's there. And you're like, oh, yeah, right on, full speed ahead. That moment, that's a truly magical moment. That's the spot. And the thing is, when you experience that, you know that, you know, it didn't come from you. It came from somewhere else. So I think as an artist are obligated to pass that along. That's part of the gift and being gifted. A gift doesn't do anything unless it moves. So you pass it along.
You also said the other day when we were talking that you make artworks to amuse yourself. How do you keep it fun?
Well, that's totally, totally true. I mean, partially I love problem solving. So I keep thinking up things that are, you know, harder and harder for me to do. I'm always trying new materials, new media, and that's fun. That's really fun for me. I'm good at it. So I like thinking up new things to play with, but also just like amusing myself. I mean, the big pink stealth has a hatch door in it and pink button tufted like automotive upholstery and speakers and an iPod shuffle, and it plays like chick rock, and it totally amuses me.
Well, I have to say, I was very impressed by the snake piece in which you actually used the skin of the snake that lives in the art supply store on Cerritos Road.
Yeah, Delilah. Yeah, I mean, she is, if you've been in there and see this snake, she's...
It's an artisan.
Artisans, yeah. And now you can actually see it because they've done new construction. She has a new room. You kind of go around the side to the left, and she's in there. And she's like a living archetype. I mean, this is a huge snake.
It's a very python, scary snake.
Like over, she's over 200 pounds. I don't even know how big she is now, but even if you like snakes, this snake makes your rat brain just like, run away. She's like, blah. So, the snake is an archetype that I've used a lot over and over. And it was really a privilege to be able to use this skin. This is her shed skin. So it's like the piece has a real, like, interesting and weird life to it that... It's kind of unlike anything I've ever made. And underneath the skin, there's glow-in-the-dark paint, this, like, super glowing pigment. It's sort of a relatively new type of glow-in-the-dark pigment that glows, like, four times brighter and 10 times longer than the old glow-in-the-dark stuff. So it glows between the scales. When you turn the lights off...
Are you going to be able to turn the lights off for people in the gallery?
We'll just tell people to stand still for a minute and turn the lights off because, yeah, it's totally intense. And the weird thing is when the lights are on, it's kind of static. And when you turn the lights off and it just glows, you swear it's moving. It shifts into a completely other realm. I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing. And so, like...
There's your shamanic piece.
Well, it's a hugely shamanic piece because it's about the Kabbalah tree of life and tarot overlaid with my own interpretations. And, I mean, that's the thing. The way I work with archetypes is I start out with sort of my own personal narratives. And then this is how I started investigating archetypes because I would make a piece. This is when I was at school in Kansas City. Make a piece and then... be looking at a book of, I don't know, ancient Chinese art and see something that looked exactly like something I had just made, but it was made 3,000 years ago on the other side of the earth. And it kind of wigged me out. And so I really started investigating what archetypes are and how they work.
And you feel like you and these artists 3,000 years ago are all sort of accessing the same.
Absolutely. It's you know, it's the visual language that Dane Rudyard, the astrologer, called it images of man's soul. This is the visual language, the language everyone knows. And I mean, that's what makes an archetype. It's an image that crosses all cultures and time. So when you work with archetypes, it's kind of important to really get what the stuff is about. And I don't know, it's something that always has come pretty naturally to me. I just access that, but with my own personal narrative. So generally my work has sort of my personal narrative overlaid over the archetypal. So the snake piece is called Shining Path, which is a diagram in the Tree of Life in the shape of a snake that's always been drawn. It's a specific meditation between the different points on the Tree of Life. And at each of the 10 points on the Tree of Life in this snake, there's little hatch doors, and they hatch open, and there's a little small painting that corresponds to the tarot card, but also is more a personal narrative of mine. So, I mean, it's a really complex piece. I don't profess to know a lot about Kabbalah. I study Tarot some, but it's, like I said, it's my interpretation. And I've had people kind of question my Tree of Life placement stuff, and sort of like, well, you know, this is my shining path. It's not necessarily anyone else's. This is my shining path. These are my moments in time. So,
well, we're just about out of time, but I want to thank you for being here. Erica Wanamaker is an artist whose exhibition I Stole Stealth, Coyote Taught Me opens tonight at the Linda Durham Gallery from 5 to 7 in the evening. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks for letting me come.
You are listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Stay tuned. I'd like to welcome now Bridget Lindquist. She's the executive director of the Espanola Valley Humane Society and is here to talk about the Halloween Masquerade Ball.
That was beautifully pronounced, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having me.
And it's October 27th from 5:30 to 11 at night at El Museo Cultural in Santa Fe. And it's a masquerade. Do you come as doggies and kitties and bunnies and stuff?
Well, that's a fairly common costume option. I myself am not planning on coming as a pet at all. This year we're lucky enough to have Hogel's Theatrical helping to design El Museo, and they're deliberately departing from the shelter theme. So they're doing a lot of inanimate orchids and larger-than-life vines.
Inanimate orchids.
Yeah, as opposed to the living ones. Yeah, as opposed to the walking, breathing ones.
And so people are coming as all sorts of things.
That's right.
So this is an unusual fundraiser in that you're not doing the typical fundraiser format.
We took a little bit of a risk this year, and it wasn't even because we felt that the past 14 years have failed. I think we just wanted to plan something that we ourselves would enjoy going to, which is sort of novel. So this year, instead of forcing anyone to sit down and eat, we're having a variety of noshing stations. They'll be very full-bodied, so people feel like they've been well-fed. Few different bars. I know there's going to be a martini and a margarita station in particular. And then we're also resisting the temptation to bore you by talking at you, more familiarly known as talking heads. All we're having are silent...
You never bore us, Bridget.
Boy, I tell you, you're very dear to say that. With some silent auctions and live auctions and some dancing to follow, by and large, people are able to go wherever they'd like. There's no structure, no schedule.
And there's music?
As a matter of fact, there is. Melanie Moore, who's been known locally as a remarkable DJ, is offering her talent for the night. We also have Pomegranate Studio doing some belly dancing from about 6:30 to 7, and Wise Fool will be entertaining throughout the duration. They'll be doing some aerialist acts, some fire dancing, a bit of stilt walking, things like that, just to mix it up and keep people engaged.
And so this is a Halloween thing, too, with pumpkins and vampires and all that.
It's true. I mean, how can we resist? It's the Saturday before Halloween, so most people will show up in Halloween authentic costumes. But this year, because it's more Alice in the Wonderland, you know, tumbling down the rabbit hole type thing, we encourage people to be as original as they'd like with their costume choice.
So the Espanola Valley Humane Society is a place where all sorts of animals end up, and then you try to adopt them out. And what is happening there this year? You've been the executive director for a while. How are things going?
I'd say overall they're going very well. Part of the challenge I faced when I first joined the organization was trying to understand the biggest obstacle that Espanola faces, and that's simply that there are not enough loving and responsible homes locally where we receive all our animals. So we developed a vigorous transfer program, and by and large that's been our salvation. We partner with all these wonderful shelters in Colorado that has a growing population and an ever larger base of adoptable homes or qualified adoptees.
And they have such a successful spay-neuter program that they actually have to import puppies from Espanola.
My gosh, it's like we visited about this before. That is a very accurate summary, yes. They've been ahead of their overpopulation curve for about 10 to 15 years. We're hoping to be ahead of ours in the next 10 years.
And through programs like the ones you do.
Well, actually, I was going to talk about the fact that we're partnering with Santa Fe Humane and local rescues in both Santa Fe and Rio Riba County to try to develop a region-wide spay-neuter campaign, thinking that if we pool resources, pool talent, we'll be more effective in solving the problem than we have been on our own.
So this is part of what's going on at the Espanola Valley Humane Society. There is always the question of pit bulls.
Yeah. You know, we're happy to report that 97% of our adoptable population is placed, and then there's that 3% that we'll probably never make headway on because they're pit bulls. We receive litters of pit bulls who are ineligible for transfer to Colorado. Colorado has banned the breed. Right now, it's
they really have banned the breed.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, they have. The Denver metropolitan area and the growing extended part of the suburbia has banned the breed.
So, if you have one, it's like an illegal, undocumented person.
Well, I've heard accounts that if you had one when the ban was adopted, you actually risked having that animal confiscated
Good
and
heavens.
Euthanized. So we're not able to transfer there. We're working on partnering with limited access shelters in the Phoenix extended area. But again, the biggest problem is so many pit bulls, frankly, had to flee the Denver metropolitan area that other rescues who had room no longer do.
You've got a particular pit bull named Tank.
For those of you that might have read the Santa Fe New Mexican yesterday or the Albuquerque Journal North last week, there was a wonderful article written by Jamie Tepper, one of my board members. And I think what prompted the article was really the recent Michael Vick occurrence. You know, we're on the front lines with respect to pit bull fighting, and the reality is we have these wonderful pits who sit in the shelter and we try to foster them or we try to do what we can to work with them only to have to euthanize them because we don't have anywhere to place them. Well, Tank was such a individual. We had a board meeting up at the shelter and two of our board members saw Tank, recognized that he was exceptional for any breed, particularly for the pit bull breed. They fostered him for about a week and a half, and then one of them ended up adopting him, changed his name to Barkley, and now he's an ambassador that appears everywhere throughout Santa Fe.
Is he coming to the Halloween masquerade ball?
As a matter of fact, he is. He will introduce the live auction pieces.
Woof. Bridget Lindquist is executive director of the Espanola Valley Humane Society. For more information on the Halloween ball, you can call 466-4304. It's Saturday, October 27th from 5:30 to 11 at El Museo Cultural here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website Santa Fe Radio Cafe, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.